I'm Anita Annabelle, and this is The Good Chat.
No, I'm not like compliments.
I'm quietly, I'm loving it.
I love making friends. I don't know what to tell you.
I'm a psychic. This podcast is going to be a
little chit chat.
This is probably the best chat. No, that's why this is called The Good Chat. We get good chat, mate.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Good Chat. I am your host, Anita Annabelle. In this episode, I speak to Dr. Iman Joshi. Dr. Iman chose medicine as a great way to help people while also empowering and educating them on their medical and health needs. She is surgically trained in obstetrics and gynecology. However, she has now ventured into aesthetic medicine. More recently, Dr. Iman has been a vocal advocate for the COVID vaccine and is passionate about educating the wider public from a medical standpoint. In this chat, we spoke about the great vaccine debate that is still plaguing our country. We also spoke about the dangers of social media and medical misinformation, whether vaccines should become mandatory, and how it's best to live with COVID moving into the future. I learned so much during this chat, and I hope you learned as much about this topic as I did. Here's Dr. Iman Joshi. Thank you so much for coming on to The Good Chat today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's really exciting to be here and to meet you.
And to meet you too. This is such an interesting topic that we are going to be talking about today. COVID, the COVID vaccine, something that has been plaguing the world for 2 years now. But before we speak about that, I would love to talk about how you got into medicine, because you have a very interesting story. And I think it's a really great way for people to kind of understand who you are. So how did you get into medicine?
Look, honestly, when people ask me this, I don't really remember. It's not like I was never one of those people that sort of thought I wanted to be a doctor for as long as I could remember or anything like that. To the best of my recollection, it was just something that came over me gradually. I was going to do a PhD in science because that was sort of where my interest lay. Mm. And I was always into research, and I like having lots of alone time. So, you know, sitting in a lab with pipettes and having lots of free time to do whatever I wanted by myself was always the appeal. But then I think at some stage while I was doing that, I really realize that I actually really like helping people. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much that I have an aversion to being around people. It's just I'm not a big crowds person, mm-hmm. but I love one-on-one interactions. I love educating people. I love empowering people. I love helping break down complex and complicated concepts for them in a way that they can understand. Mm. And so then when it was time to go to university, I kind of thought, well, I could do science, but then there's lots of periods where I'm going to be alone and not really have that ability to educate and teach and empower people. And science tends to be quite a lengthy process. You know, between the time that you start research and get results, it could be a decade or more, usually. And so then I sort of thought medicine or teaching. And then I ended up choosing medicine because it allows me to help people, allows me to serve people. But a huge component of medicine done well is educating and empowering people. And it kind of felt like a very timely way of doing it. And that's how it started.
And I think, you know, one thing, particularly with the topic that you and I are going to be talking at length today about.
Yes.
That is something that people need to know. They need the knowledge. They need the information.
Absolutely.
And we need to empower them to make the right choices for them.
Yes.
So this is something that I really want to talk to you about is how people can make the right choices for them and all of the medical misinformation that's out there. Let's talk about the great vaccine debate, which is really why I got you on today. Why are you so passionate about educating about the vaccine?
Look, honestly, it probably comes back again to this idea. And I think medicine by its very nature is a very conservative industry, right? So we're so patient focused, but a lot of that is about one-on-one education. So what happens behind closed doors stays behind closed doors. We have very strict laws and rules around confidentiality, what we can and can't say. We're not even allowed to talk about somebody, let's say, that I might have seen half an hour ago. If I were to disclose that to somebody else who wasn't a doctor, for example, or in a related capacity, if by doing that, I'm going to leak enough details that then that person becomes identifiable. Mm. So there are all these really strict rules around patient confidentiality, patient-centered care. But what a lot of doctors now, especially of our age group, generation, are recognizing is that while we're busy doing lots of good work one-on-one behind closed doors, there's an entire world of social media out there that's opened up to everybody. And every single person out there, without any qualifications, without the ability to actually read scientific data and not much less to interpret them accurately and correctly, is getting on their bandwagon. And they may have 1,000 followers, they may have 20,000 followers, they may have 1,000,000 followers, and they feel qualified to comment on something of which they have very actual little knowledge. Mm. And I think for a lot of healthcare workers, it feels really personal because we're not getting a single, you know, most of us aren't really making money off this. We're not selling snake oil. We're not getting endorsements from big pharmaceuticals or anything like that. We're literally here trying to help people make good decisions for themselves. Same as when we say stop smoking or wear sunscreen or whatever it is. But people are led by emotion. And with medicine, when we're talking to people, we're not allowed to lead with medicine. We're not allowed to say, if you don't get it, you'll die. Because that's very bad, right?
Yeah.
That's a bad doctor. You get a slap on the wrist if you say something like that. You're meant to be measured and you're meant to talk to people. You're meant to educate them in a way, hopefully, that plants seeds that then allows them to make that decision for themselves. And we're there every step of the way, but we're not selling them anything. And that's not sexy and that's not smart. And it doesn't really sell the way, you know, someone with 50,000 followers might go, ivermectin is what you want to use, and here I am selling it to you for $90 or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and it's so scary the amount of people that do put things out on social media. That's something I do really want to talk to you about at length.
Yeah,
I guess what's scary about it is that there's so much knowledge out there from people who are having who have misinformation, who are spreading misinformation. There's also so many things coming from so many different angles. It's really hard for the normal person to sit there and go, what is actually correct?
Yes.
And what's
scary? And who do I believe?
And who do I believe? Yeah. And what scares me is that we are at the time of recording, we are at 80% vaxxed, which is wonderful, but that's only just people over 16. So we've still got
we're only 64% total population.
Only 64% total population. Yep. See, and that's going to be a whole other conversation in itself. You know, when do we vaccinate the kids? So that's definitely something I want to talk about today. Firstly, we've been living with this pandemic for 2 years now.
Yeah.
As a healthcare professional, how has it changed from the beginning to now?
Look, honestly, some of it is probably my own personal history as well, because I was at a general practice in Sydney CBD when all of this happened. Mm-hmm. And so I still remember within the space of about a week, because for a while we were hearing all the grumblings around late February about this virus that's come out of China, that's, you know, and we were watching on television what was happening in Italy and these sort of, you know, makeshift morgues that they were erecting and the rest of it. And obviously people were quite scared and concerned, but our government didn't really seem to be taking it too seriously at that point. And then it felt almost like within the space of a week, we sort of decided we were going to take it seriously. And I kind of remember around the first or second week of March, people started being sent to work from home. And so obviously the largest proportion of my patients were patients in the CBD itself. And I remember over the space of that week seeing lots of them because they just wanted prescriptions for the next 6 months. Everybody was thinking it was going to blow
Everyone
over.
Everyone was panicking. I remember,
But I also remember, you know, colleagues posting on medical Facebook groups and stuff going, I'm really, you know, I've got trips to Fiji or Bali or whatever booked for July, booked for August, and I hope this thing will be over by then. And now you look back and it's such naivete that we kind of went, oh yeah, you know, 2-3 months and we'll be done. But in the space of that 1 week, it's not my practice, but the practice that I was at went from sort of full and bustling, seeing people on a regular basis, to completely just closed. And I found myself out of work there, so no income. And then I just not long prior to that opened up my own skin clinic at Liverpool. And so I made the decision before the mandate to close that because it was completely non-essential. And I kind of thought, at the moment with all these unknowns, I can't in good conscience stay open.
Absolutely.
So in the space of a week, I went from working, having a regular income, to having zero.
As a healthcare professional, you lost your job.
Well, we're not employed, so we're all self-employed. So, right. So most doctors are self-employed. We're not employees. We don't have leave benefits and the rest of it. So if you don't see people, you don't make any money. And that's literally how it works. So I went to having zero income in about the space of a week. And so then I went and put my name out to all the locum agencies. And it just so happened about a week, 10 days after that, I got a call saying, we need you for some kind of, you know, COVID work, but we don't know what it is. And I just went, yes. Because by then I had no income for 10 days. I had no idea what was going to happen next. I had no idea. Everyone was sort of panicking and had no idea what was going to happen. And basically that started me on 18 to 20 months now of COVID-related work. And I've done it in every that there is, from hotel quarantine to COVID testing clinics to vaccine advocacy and work there. Anyway, so I've kind of been at the front line along with all the other frontline workers from day one.
Yeah.
And so I guess we take it really personally when all the misinformation started out there, because it felt really, really personal to us, especially when people were expressing misinformation about the vaccines. And we knew firsthand, I think for a lot of us, it was like, we have literally put our lives on the line for you without vaccines. We've gone to work in these uncomfortable clothes. We've taken the risk of taking the virus back to our families, and you're refusing a life-saving vaccine.
It goes without saying, thank you so much from the general public for being in the front line. We cannot even imagine what you've been, what you've seen, what you're going through. And also thank you for keeping us safe and for helping people who are ill. It's quite an incredible thing to do.
And can I just say, you guys, the Australian population, especially in New South Wales, has blown our minds out of the water, because we kind of thought we would get to 70% and then things would slow down and then we'd crawl along. But at the moment, we're nearly at 92% of the 16 plus population single dose,
which is great.
Nearly 91% 12 plus population. Mm. And there's every chance that if we approve the vaccines for the under 12s, that we'll probably have a bit uptake there as well. So none of this could have been possible. And for all the noise being made by the vaccine hesitant and the anti-vaccine group, I think the proof is in the pudding that by and large, we're a nation that loves science and that loves to vaccinate and that looks after each other, which is just fantastic.
And that's the key, the looking after one another. Because you're actually not just doing it for yourself. You're doing it for your mum, your sisters, your brothers, your nephews, your cousins, your grandparents.
And the children who can't be vaccinated at the moment.
And the children who can't be vaccinated. I guess one thing I would like to know is the common myths surrounding the vaccine. Where do they come from?
So look, a lot of it, I think, this is based on what I've heard from patients the whole time that I was talking to them about the vaccines, is a lot of hesitancy and I think a lot of fear and mistrust that's been sown into people, or it certainly was in the early days, about how can they come up with a vaccine in a mere 12 months? So a lot of people distrusted the process. They believed that it was just too soon for an effective vaccine to have been made so quickly, and not just one, but obviously three or four brands that were presumably effective. And so, you know, so that was one of the very common myths. The other one was that I'm not putting poison in my body, or I'm not putting a toxin in my body. And again, this was sort of, I think, perpetuated by a fringe group of healthcare workers who may or may not have looked into the scientific evidence or data themselves and have made their own predictions on the basis of that. Because the other thing to remember is, even amongst healthcare workers, and I can only speak for doctors because obviously they're the group that I largely deal with, except for the handful of nurses that I have as colleagues and friends where we may have the occasion to talk about it. But by and large, as doctors, when we're mainstream, most of us would defer to public health and to the epidemiologists. So none of us would have that hubris of saying, I have an MD, therefore I'm qualified to comment on this. Because it's that whole thing about the Dunning-Kruger effect, you know, which is basically that when you learn a little bit, you think you know far more than you do, and you become overconfident and cocky. And then as you learn more, you recognize just how little you know and how much more there is to know about a particular topic. And that humbles you in the process. And so it was really quite ironic that when we were listening to this, people were coming across as very, very confident, often based on a throwaway article that they may have read by somebody who might have been a fringe healthcare worker or something, but who came across as very confident, very boisterous, very, 100% committed to whatever their ideas were. And on the basis of that, they were saying all these things and often selling ivermectin on this side. But that's neither here nor there. So I think a lot of that was, how can it have been made so quickly? Are there poisons in there? And a lot of people used to say to me, especially in the earlier days, they used to say, I'm not anti-vaccine, but. And so there was always that but, because they used to, that for in their mind, it was, I'm not anti-vaccine. My children are all vaccinated. I'm vaccinated against childhood immunizations, but the COVID vaccine is too new. It's unknown. If they're going to make a vaccine to COVID, why haven't they made a vaccine for cancer? And I'd often have this discussion with them and say, cancer is an entirely different, it's not a disease. Like, it's a disease of replication. It's not an infectious disease. So they work differently. And the one cancer that comes to memory that is transmissible, the HPV vaccine virus, now has a vaccine. So a lot of it was just, and a lot of people who were vaccine hesitant initially, they were happy to listen, especially if they have that relationship with you where you explain stuff to them and they go, oh, actually that makes sense. And then, they're happy to be converted, so to speak. So I also found in my experience that the vast majority of people who were vaccine hesitant, as in they had genuine concerns, but they weren't necessarily rabidly against it, were happy to be explained to, and then usually ended up making the choice that was best for them and their families and the community, which was to go ahead and get vaccinated.
So you've mentioned quite a few times about everyone saying that this is so new and people were really hesitant because it was so new. Can you explain how it happened so quickly, how you can get a vaccine so quick?
Yeah. So two main things. The AstraZeneca vaccine that we're talking about was based more on the sort of the relatively well-known long-standing technology, which is how the measles virus and other viruses get made, which is that we usually use part of the outside coating of a particular virus, a protein, and we then inject that into you. And when it gets through your system, your body, your immune cells initially don't recognize it. It takes them up to about 2 weeks to generate the beginnings of an antibody response to it, and then the vaccine gets eliminated from your system. So there was a lot of talk about this affecting your DNA and causing infertility problems and stuff, which again, scientifically is untrue, because the vaccine gets eliminated from your system like anything else once it's done its job. So the vaccine is like a messenger. It comes, it gives you the letter. You get the letter and now I'm going to go.
That is such a great way of saying it.
Yeah. So it doesn't hang around and set up house in your home. Yeah. Which is what a lot of people thought, and then go around breaking into your doors and breaking into your reproductive system and creating a whole lot of havoc. It doesn't do that. So that's sort of similar to the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is based on the old trusted tried technology. The newer technology is the mRNA vaccines, which work slightly differently. So they're basically a piece of messenger RNA, which is the type of protein that we have. And you inject that and it basically tells your body how to make the protein that you're going to mount a response to. Now, since the initial SARS outbreak back in 2003, people have been working on these vaccines all this time for at least 10 years. So when people say, oh, this is too quick, I guess they're under the impression that this has only been 12 months in the making, but it hasn't. People have been working on this for a very long time. And with the occurrence of this particular pandemic, it just allowed a few things. Companies started throwing lots of money at scientists to get this really ramped up. So funding is normally an issue with a lot of academia. And in this case, because we were literally racing against time, a lot of companies, started
like,
throwing
here,
lots
take
of the big
our
bucks.
Money. Yeah.
Exactly. To start and to sort of fast track the technology. That was number one. Number two, lots of people were working on it. And because everybody was focusing on the vaccine technologies, we had obviously lots of other vaccines that didn't quite make the cut, but it also enabled us to then come up with a handful that did make the cut. And then number three, related to that, obviously, this comes back to the whole distrust thing, is that initially, because people were dying in such huge numbers in the US, the UK and Europe, a lot of those countries approved some of the initial vaccines under an emergency use approval or an EUA. And so the FDA used that term of an emergency use approval or an experimental drug at the beginning. This is back in January that they used it this year. And so people latched onto that. And then we started getting the whole, it's an experimental drug, it's an experimental drug. But it's never been an experimental drug as far as Australia is concerned, because the TGA has not issued an EUA for any of our vaccines. For two simple reasons. We did so well, we were much lower on the risk, on the list for when we were going to get the vaccines. That's number one. And that also meant that we had plenty of time to watch the vaccine being administered to literally millions of people. So most vaccines and most drugs, after they get released past the testing trials into the community, drug companies follow them for a year or two just to look for any significant adverse side effects, et cetera, et cetera. And usually that might be, you know, tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people as a big sample size. In this case, we've had over, you know, we had, to date, we've had something like over 4 million people vaccinated, or maybe 4 billion. I can't remember. I think 4 billion, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or 4 billion doses, I think it is. It's
a lot of doses.
Of people vaccinated. Yeah. Yeah. And so the idea again is we've had such a massive sample size by the time it got to Australia. The TGA said, we're going to not do emergency use approval because we don't need to rush. We're not losing people. People aren't dying, you know, in our streets as we're doing this. And number three, we have lots of data from the other countries based on millions of people who've been vaccinated. Therefore, they used all of that data to approve the vaccine for our use.
This makes a lot of sense why we got the vaccine so late. And I think that when I say late, to us, to the general public who do not know that background, we felt like we were late to the party. Why didn't we?
A lot of outcry.
There was so much outcry. Why didn't we get this information? Yeah. Or did we get this information and people skimmed over it? Because I feel like if I had known that we weren't getting that emergency vaccine and we were waiting to ensure that this vaccine was something that was safe for the entire population, I think that would have really, you know, there wouldn't have been such outcry.
Helped calm people down. Yeah. Look, it's really interesting that you say that, because I think that anger probably really only started once we ran into trouble with the AstraZeneca vaccine. Because initially we were slated to start offering the AstraZeneca vaccine, remember, around February, March this year. And it was going to be initially for, you know, because we'd stratified people into 1A, 1B.
That's right. And then the other 2A, 2B, and whatever it was.
That's right. And I think it would be fair to say to some degree, mainstream media sort of botched it up as well, because they sort of took some of the adverse events and they ran with it and created a whole lot of public hesitance, a lot of fear-mongering, a lot of doubts in people's minds that then twisted the government's arms, and ATAGI, which is the advisory council for the use of vaccines, twisted their arm in terms of what was safe and what wasn't. And what they said was never out of line. What they said was, everything that we do in medicine has a risk and benefit analysis. So if I'm going to, for example, if you come and see me and you want to go on the pill for contraception, there's a series of history and questions that I have to ask you. There are certain things where if you say yes to any of those, I'm going to say you are not a good candidate for the pill. Here is why. Here are some alternatives for contraception instead, right? So those are things known as absolute contraindications. They're rare, but in somebody who has any of those risks, the answer would be that in terms of safety, the risk outweighs the benefit for you. Therefore, we should not prescribe it for you. And vaccines are no different. It's just that because of all the hype around the AstraZeneca vaccine, coupled with the fact that at the time, until about June, we had zero COVID, the ATAGI reasonably surmised that the risk was too high, even of a 1 in a million chance of death with the AstraZeneca vaccine, compared to waiting for Pfizer, which at that stage did not have that risk. Now, since then, we know, based on much larger studies, that the risks are probably similar for both. And obviously, Pfizer then has the risk of myocarditis in younger men as well.
I actually did have the Pfizer vaccine, and I noticed that it did mess with my menstrual cycle just for the first one.
Yes.
I think I was 2 weeks late on my period. And I know that everybody has different side effects when it comes to these vaccines. You know, it's like anything that you put in your body, you're always going to have a different side effect. And so there's always a level of risk when you are putting a vaccine in your body. But unlike, I guess, you know, I'm very pro-vaccine for so many reasons, and everybody is obviously entitled to their own opinion. But I guess this whole misinformation coming out, that's what is detrimental to our society, because exactly like you were saying before, you know, if somebody has influence, if an influencer has 50,000 followers and they come out and say that they don't want the vaccine, it should be pro-choice, it should be et cetera, et cetera, then we're actually... Their followers are going to go after that. I mean, there was the case of Sam Frost, who's on Home and Away. She also was the Bachelorette. She has a huge following, and she has a huge following of impressionable young kids. And it's that's the scary thing is that if she's misinformed and then she spreads that misinformation, that is what is concerning to me, and I know it is concerning to you. So in terms of the information, why is this detrimental to society as a whole, and how can we combat that?
Look, I think that's probably a couple of things that come out when influencers talk about something that isn't relevant to their particular field or their area of expertise or whatever. But the other, you know, the other argument, exactly as you've said, is that most of these people, when they talk about being pro-choice, what they're really saying is, I'm not going to do this, and you can't say anything or do anything to change my mind. But in the process of making that known, because it's one thing to have an opinion, right? But opinions aren't facts. That's number one. So you may have an opinion that a vaccine is unsafe for you, and you've decided not to have it for whatever reason. But coming out onto social media to then publicize that is taking it into the public arena.
Yeah, of course.
Where a lot of impressionable people are going to be listening, who might like you as a presenter, might like you as an actor, might like you as a dancer, or whatever your particular role is. And people often don't have the ability, when we have an emotional attachment to somebody, to be able to differentiate between this person is a great dancer, this person's a great actor, this person's a great writer, and they're not a medical doctor, and they do not have the knowledge to be able to dissect this article or this journal article or this evidence.
Yeah.
And therefore, I should limit my following and my love for them to their writing, acting, dancing, whatever it might be, and get my information from a trusted source who may not be as sexy or as personable or do dances or whatever it is. You know what I mean? But I think a lot of that is that it speaks to the fear that people have, that very small fear that what if something goes wrong? And, you know, honestly, I've always had this love-hate relationship with vaccines, even though I'm pro-vaccine, even though I'm vaccinated, my children are vaccinated, whatever, because there was that paper 20-something years ago by Andrew Wakefield in, you know, in a very well-known, respected medical article where he basically made up that whole thing about the MMR vaccines causing autism. And you know, it's still, he's been debunked tens of thousands of times since then. But I remember when I took my children to get their childhood vaccines, there was that tiny, tiny mum part of me, even though I'm a doctor, even though I give vaccines all the time, even though, there was that tiny part of me that sort of went, what if he was right? And so if I can do that as a person who's trained in science, who loves science, who believes in science, who knows how to read science, I, you know, I understand why people might have that hesitance or that fear. But the trick then is to then have a relationship with somebody who is reliable and take your concerns and fears to them instead of influences. Yeah.
I was born in 1986, and Mum, I swear Mum has told me this story, that there was someone the year before I was born or the year before my sister was born, and she was born in 84, and it was, there was definitely, she swears there was a case.
There was a fear.
Yeah, well, there was an actual case that she knew of, but my mum has always vaccinated us from, you know, from the get-go, but she, that was a really big fear for her, because she lost a baby when she was a week old, a preemie baby, and so Mum, you know, to have that fear on top of losing a child and then yes. not wanting to lose yep. other children.
Exactly. And it's the emotion, you know, it's the emotion aspect of it. And I often think a lot of people, when they're influencing you on social media, they're feeding into that aspect. They're feeding into that fear of loss, of bad outcomes, of poor outcomes. Yeah. And that's what they're feeding. And so, you know I speak for a lot of healthcare workers and doctors where we've often had this conversation, and on the basis of that, people have kind of gone, okay, I'm going to go ahead. And obviously for a long time, we had no Pfizer, and a lot of people under the age of 40 were getting the AstraZeneca. And I, you know, my DMs were exploding with all these people at the time where I was trying to help them find people close to them or within that 5 kilometer radius or whatever that was yeah. going on during Sydney lockdown. A lot of, you know, women were contacting me and going, I'm breastfeeding, so I should wait for Pfizer. And I was like, no, you can have the AstraZeneca. And, you know, to their credit, a lot of people, once they kind of, and I always used to say, I'm not your doctor, I'm not asking you personal information, but just the general information is, yes, you can, but you need to go and talk to a doctor about that. And so many of them did. And then they'd come back and they'd send me snapshots of themselves having their, you know, their little jab with the Band-Aid on top of it, or texting me and going, I had my jab, thank you so much, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there are lots of good people out there, and there are lots of really sensible people who have the fear, who have the discussion, and have their fears allayed enough to then go and do what's right for them.
The fear thing is very interesting to me, because I had Barry Dubois on this podcast, and we were talking just days after the protests. And our initial thing was that these people have gone out because of fear. They just want to be heard, yeah. and they're fearful yeah. of what is going to happen to them. And how yes. do you feel about the protests that happened?
Look, honestly, I remember being on social media again, and I remember seeing a lot of anger and a lot of sort of anger towards the people, because it's like, you know, you're protesting against the very thing that you're likely to extend, et cetera, et cetera. And I honestly think I would agree with your guest in the sense that probably a lot of these people who were protesting felt unheard. And when people feel unheard, or when they feel picked on, or when they feel demoralized, you know, and I think as humans, we all have this pile-on mentality yeah. where we end up making our own echo chambers. You know, I agree with you, you agree with me, let's be buddies, and let's gang up on anybody else who disagrees. It's a very human condition. I think it's a very human trait. And I think in the process, as we sort of rapidly started ramping up our vaccination program, it probably left a minority who felt unheard, or who were very, very anti-vaccines for no reason. I mean, I remember I had one person say, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I'm offended that people call me an anti-vaxxer. I'm not like those mindless sheep who just follow everybody else. I'm somebody who's critically, literally, this was the quote in social media on a public post. And I'm somebody that's critically thought about it and has decided not to get vaccinated. So there are people who actually hold that particular view, and then they get ridiculed for it on public posts, and then I don't know, I'm guessing they probably feel quite angry about it, and they might lash out, especially if they then connect with other like-minded people who hold similar points of view.
It is so scary, the debate that this has caused. There is such an us and them mentality. Nobody's hearing each yeah. other. Nobody's getting the yeah. information across correctly. Everybody is just angry yeah. and scared and yelling at one another, and it's, people are ruining friendships over it. And yeah. that is what's yeah. really scary, is like humanity is being torn apart because they're not knowledgeable, or they're not taking the time to learn from each other, for starters.
And I think I have a friend who actually said that to me once. She said, I would be very surprised if I was to ever meet somebody who had the same points of view as me on everything.
Yeah.
And she said, if I did, I'd probably, you know, be bored to death of being around that person. So I think to some degree, some disagreement is good and it's important. I think for me, the main issue is if we can be respectful, and I have a couple of people that have, for whatever reason, and I've tried to explore it with them in my personal life. So this is a patience where I've tried to explore why they're vaccine hesitant mm-hmm. or against vaccinations. And they've sort of come up with the whole experimental drug and very new, I'm not putting poison in my body. And I think a lot of people in hindsight probably felt pressured into getting the vaccine because our premier, cleverly or otherwise, tied the ability to work, especially from the LGAs of concern, with being vaccinated. Yeah. And in hindsight, that was actually very, very clever, because now these LGAs have some of the highest vaccination rates. But what I also saw, paradoxically, was around the time that she announced that December 1st, the unvaccinated will be able to join the vaccinated like everybody else, I had a couple of people who had the first dose then change face and go, I'm never putting an experimental vaccine into my body. So they had one dose, they had no side effects that I'm aware of, and decided not to go for the second, because in their mind, it's still an experimental vaccine. They just, it was the means to an end. And unfortunately, because of the way that the politics played out, they got their get out of jail card, so to speak. And there were quite a few people who obviously also got COVID during that time, where their entire families, children included, got COVID. They got pretty sick, not enough to end up in hospital, but still sick, who then were very pro-choice and who are probably now not going to get vaccinated.
That's
so it's interesting how that plays out. Scary. But from my perspective, when I have people talk to me about that and how they negotiate that and navigate that, I always say, you know what, when I've spoken to people like that, I've said, you know what, I still value your friendship. I value the other aspects of your life that may or may not be, you know, where we're more in alignment. But I'm probably going to put some limits in terms of what we do together while you remain unvaccinated. And so for the moment, that might mean we meet outdoors or we meet in parks rather than indoors or whatever it might be, until we see how this is going
to. And that is your right as a person to be able to say, you know, you're not vaccinated, so these are the boundaries I'm going to put in place.
Yeah.
And I guess with the vaccine, one thing that I would like to know, and this is, you mentioned the politics. Do you think vaccines should be mandatory?
Look, that brings up a whole ethical can of worms. I do think in certain industries, they should be mandatory. I mean, I know that in health, for example, it's always been mandated that we be up to date with quite a number of vaccines, many of which carry a much smaller risk depending on the kind of work that you do. So by way of example, obviously, anyone that's going to work in health, whether it's as an OT, a physio, probably cleaners, but I haven't checked, nurses, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We all have to be vaccinated, have all our childhood vaccines. We have to have proof that we are still immune to hepatitis B by vaccination. You know, we have to, if we do any blood work, so probably pathology collectors as well, we have to have annual tests for HIV, Hep B, Hep C, because on the rare chance that you might get a needle stick injury, you know, you might put the patient at risk, you might put yourself at risk. And obviously that would be even more important and relevant if you're doing surgery where you have, you know, where you're inside people's body cavities and so on. So it's always been accepted that that's what we do. A lot of hospitals and public, you know, healthcare clinics also don't mandate but strongly encourage the flu vaccine each year for staff, and most staff gets it. And again, that's not mandated, but they make it available to us free at no charge, etc., because again, they want staff protected. So in that sense, I do think that if you're going to be working in a setting, dentists, doctors, clinics, GPs, you know, hospitals, etc., etc., where you're going to be up close, prolonged contact with someone, and they may or may not be able to be vaccinated for any number of reasons, then I think it is completely ethical and right. And probably as an employer, it's an OHS issue as well, that you minimize the risk to your staff as well as to your customers, clients, patients. But I don't think it's reasonable to then mandate it for everybody.
Yeah, and actually I wanted to ask, who are the people who can't get a vaccine? Because there are people in society who would like the vaccine, so but they actually cannot have it. Who are those people?
Yeah, a very small minority. So early on in the piece, there were lots of people. And again, I was getting lots of DMs going, I have MS, can I have it? I have underactive thyroid, can I have it? I have this, can I have it? I can't have it. And honestly, if you're immune compromised, if you're undergoing chemotherapy, if you have a lot of chronic illnesses, you probably should be one of the groups that should be prioritized. And you were prioritized as a 1B initially. Mm. Because we know that people who are more vulnerable to other illnesses will also be more vulnerable to COVID. So the only really group of people at the moment that cannot have the vaccine is people who have an actual allergic reaction, such as anaphylaxis, to any of the components that make up the vaccines mm-hmm. themselves. And that's it.
And how do you know you don't, unless you're allergic?
Well, yeah, unless you have a prior documented evidence where you may have had some other medication that had the polyethylene glycol or whatever it is, or you have your first dose and then you get an anaphylactic reaction to it, then obviously you can't. And again, AstraZeneca, the preservative they use is different to your mRNA vaccines. So again, there might be some room to move with that as well. But literally, that's about the only reason. And the only other second reason would be if someone has had COVID and they're not yet recovered from the acute symptoms of having had COVID itself. So the recommendation then is to wait until all your symptoms have gone before you then stress your system out again with a vaccine. That's literally it. All these people going around asking for medical exemptions on grounds yeah. that they believe to be true, it's not true, large, by and large.
I did put a call out on Instagram and you very kindly shared it as well. We got a few questions about the vaccine. Why are we still seeing cases of COVID even if you have the vaccine? Why is that?
Okay. So the vaccines are not 100% effective. Okay, so that's number one. So having been vaccinated gives you something like a 92 to 94% protection mm-hmm. against COVID that's severe enough to end up in hospitalizations and death. And at the moment, we know that that's probably valid for at least mm-hmm. a year based on an initial two-course mm-hmm. dose. So that's number one. So if you are vaccinated, it doesn't mean that you won't get COVID. It just means that your chances are significantly reduced, much, much lower than an unvaccinated person. And even if you do end up getting COVID despite being vaccinated, and that's called a breakthrough COVID mm-hmm. infection. So, the COVID has broken through the barrier of the vaccine and infected you anyway. And the vast majority of those people will either have no symptoms, so you unless you get tested, you won't know that you've actually had COVID, or it might be so mild as to resemble just a common cold or whatever.
So it's really like the flu vaccine.
To a degree, but the flu vaccine is slightly different because we know that that particular virus mutates rapidly, and that's uh-huh. why the vaccine needs to be slightly modified every year.
Okay.
Because we're sort of playing a little bit of a gamble on which way we think the mutation is going to mm-hmm. occur, and we hope that that's going to be enough. With COVID, it's stable enough at the moment that the vaccines that we've made, despite the slight mutations that we've seen and the variants, that it's still effective against them. So it's not quite the same. The thing that makes COVID a little bit tricky is that it does not confer what we call sterilizing immunity,
okay.
like we do with the measles virus, for example. So because COVID is transmitted through the nose, it's very hard to then have a vaccine that protects us from breathing the COVID in, especially if you're not wearing a mask. And therefore, it just very slightly increases your risk of exposure and possibly taking that into your system. So it doesn't give you sterilizing immunity. Sterilizing immunity means you just knock it out. Your shield is so effective, if the virus hits it, it doesn't go anywhere. And that's what herd immunity relies on.
Is it true? I'm scared to ask this. Is it true that everyone will end up getting COVID?
It's true. We probably will all end up getting COVID.
Oh.
We will.
Really?
Yeah. So, yes. Yeah, really. Because we don't have herd immunity with Delta.
Yeah, of course. Right. The strain.
And therefore, what we used to rely on, this is again what the anti-vaccination crowd used to rely on. So if they were conscientious objectors to childhood vaccines, for example, what they were relying on was that enough of the herd, which is the rest of community, was vaccinated so that when the virus meets a vaccinated person, it stops dead in its track.
Right?
Because that person doesn't get infected and therefore doesn't transmit it, doesn't take it home to the next person, doesn't expose an unvaccinated mm-hmm. person. That's how herd immunity works. The other way to get herd immunity is to infect everybody, except that some people are going to die because of it, and then the rest of you can party on.
Literally.
Which is an unacceptable way of gaining herd immunity. But that's kind of what the UK did, right? And Sweden to some degree, because they kind of went, we'll accept it, we'll learn to live with COVID and see what happens. And obviously poorer places like India, because they didn't have access to the vaccines. And so that's how they got to where they did. Because the idea is when you have a novel coronavirus or a new virus coming into a community, you have an entirely virus naive population. So you have a population whose immune system has never met the virus. And that means none of us, if we're not vaccinated, know how we're going to respond to it. We could have really mild symptoms. We could have no symptoms. We could be slightly sick for a few days. We could be severely sick enough to end up in hospital, ventilated, or die. So the whole point of getting vaccinated to COVID is that you do it in a graded fashion. You introduce your immune system. You say, here's the manual for COVID. Here's what it does. Here's what it looks like. This is what it is. It's a security alarm system, basically, so that the next time when COVID meets you, your immune system goes, we know this intruder. We've recognized it. We have the armamentarium for it. And therefore, we're going to get on top of it and either squash it so that we have no symptoms, or it might overwhelm us slightly, but not enough, and we'll just push it out the door. So yes, we'll all get COVID eventually. Cool. But the bonus is if you're vaccinated and we haven't had boosters yet, getting even a mild infection will boost your immunity again.
There is another booster shot at the moment. Who needs to get the booster shot?
Okay, so this is, I think you're referencing the Atagi statement in the last week or so that talked about people who have severe immune compromise.
Okay,
So the difference is it's not a booster. So for this particular group of people who are severely immune compromised, and there's just a very small comprehensive list of diseases that meet that criteria, the basic underpinning theory behind this is that for these people, because their immune systems are severely compromised because they have cancer, they're undergoing chemotherapy, they may have had bone marrow transplant, et cetera, et cetera. So for these people, a two-dose course isn't mm-hmm. enough to mount an appropriate immunity. And therefore, for them, it's not a booster. It's the third of a three-dose course.
Okay, right.
Yep. So at the moment, I think it came into effect last week, it's only for this very small group of people with severe immune compromise.
Meaning you have no
immune
system.
So you and me, if we're worrying about our immunity waning, because like I had mine in February and March. So technically I should be getting, you know, advice on a booster now, along with a lot of frontline healthcare workers, but we're waiting on our target for that. So if you and I were worried that, you know, our immunity is waning and we should be getting the boosters, et cetera, we're not eligible under that unless severely compromised. You can't go to your GP and say, I want to see what my booster, what my vaccine is doing. So there's no way to test for it, right? So we can't test that for you. And so that's why we're waiting on guidance. So for the moment, Atagi had come out and said, at the moment, there's just this very tiny subpopulation. Because the other concern is if people have boosters too soon when they don't need it, it might trigger an overactive reaction to the booster, which then might cause more harm than good. So it's not as simple as going, I worry that I'm low, I'll just get a booster.
Which is, I think, a lot of people are thinking, well, maybe I'm immunocompromised, but you're not immunocompromised unless your doctor tells you are. So,
exactly. Unless you actually come out and ask your questions, you can feel alone and you fail to recognize that there are a lot of other people who probably feel similarly. And then if you go onto, I don't know, a Facebook group or whatever, and then there's all these worried people, it turns into this echo chamber where everyone comes out going, oh my God, I'm going to die the moment I go out to the shops because I'm sure my immunity is gone and I'm immune compromised and I'm just... Instead, if you then go and actually talk to your doctor and sit down and have that conversation, you might be able to get your fears allayed. And a reason for why, maybe, you shouldn't be rushing to get a booster just yet.
And with the ever-growing strains of COVID, because we've got the Delta strain now, and is it true that there's 8 new strains? How does that work when it comes to COVID vaccines?
Yeah. So there are new variants coming out, and I know Dr. Chant was referencing one of them, which was sort of a variant of the Delta that was discovered in Sydney a couple of weeks ago from memory, whenever she was last talking about. So the WHO at the moment looks at these new strains coming out, and the way that new variants come out is basically whenever the virus meets an unvaccinated person, they meet a naive immune system, and in the process, they have a chance to change just that tiny little bit to make it a little bit easier for them, theoretically, to evade your immune system. So the easiest way to talk about it is if you, say, aren't vaccinated and I come to your house and I'm an intruder, I'm the virus, right? Let's say I'm Delta and I come. The first time I come, for example, I might be dressed the way I am. Let's say I come and you're not vaccinated, and in the process, I might take a scarf with your scarf with me and I might just change it. So now it's no longer lavender, it might be blue. Or I might just add a little bow tie or whatever. So it's just very tiny changes with every unvaccinated person that the virus meets that has the potential for the virus to mutate just that tiny little bit to make it easier for it. Because the virus isn't a living organism. It's just an opportunistic pathogen. It has no feelings. It doesn't stop and think, should I infect you or this
you can
person?
Tell.
It's just a replicating machine,
you
right?
You can tell it has no feelings, obviously.
And a whole bunch of unvaccinated humans is a literal feast, right? So every time it feasts on an unvaccinated person, it has the ability to change tiny bit. But at the moment, there is no evidence that the vaccine can't be effective against any of the known variants to date. So the WHO classifies them separately. It's either a variant of interest, where they're just watching to see what happens, like came out in Brazil for a while. I think there was a lambda from memory, or maybe the gamma. I can't remember. It was one of the Greek letters. But it kind of burnt out on its own over there. Delta was the one that started in India, because it suddenly had this mass population, and then it just ripped through them. The ones who survived now have immunity. The rest are getting vaccinated. But in the process, it ended up going everywhere else.
So those who survived, can they get COVID again?
Yes.
And it can kill them?
Probably not. So this is the other reason why some people will say, so this was one of the other common questions I used to get, which was, I've already had COVID, so I don't need to get the vaccine. And the answer is yes, you do, because, again, your immunity is going to wane. And at the moment, the vaccine is far more effective against different variants of COVID than you having immunity to the one strain that you were exposed to. Therefore, the general recommendation still stands, which is that for the moment, if you're over the age of 12, even if you have had COVID, once your symptoms have all gone and you're back to normal, you should get vaccinated, because you could get infected again.
What about children under 12?
So there's a lot of anxiety around children at the moment. There's some conflicting data that's obviously come out of the US, the UK, and then in other parts, such as Canada, for example, as well as, you know, parts of the US, such as San Francisco versus Florida, for example. So basically, a couple of things. Pfizer has applied to the FDA, and last I checked, their meeting on the 6th of November to talk about emergency use approval to begin vaccinating children under the ages 5 to 11 in the US. And it's anticipated that that'll probably start around Halloween, so in the next couple of weeks. Canada in British Columbia has started accepting registrations for kids ages 5 to 11, and they've applied. So they're anticipating that as soon as they get approval from their regulatory body, that they might start vaccinating kids again this week or next week. So the benefit of that for us is that we will, again, like we did earlier this year and late last year, get to watch and see how these children fare. In the US, where they have 28 million eligible kids in that age group, and in Canada, I don't know the numbers in Canada. The main thing to keep in mind is, for a long time, everybody was waiting to vaccinate kids ages 5 to 11 because it was like, it's a vaccine, vaccines are good, I'm pro-choice, I'm pro-vaccine, whatever it is. But kids' physiologies are not the same as adults. right? They're not just little adults in little bodies.
Yeah.
They have different physiology. And so the concern being raised by a lot of pediatricians at the moment is that because, one, COVID tends to be largely mild in kids under the age of 12. That's number one. Number two, we don't know if the vaccine has any significant side effects and risks that might then outweigh any benefits from the kids being vaccinated, unlike in adults where we know that the benefit clearly outweighs the risk. So because of that, the bar at which we're going to set to say, yes, we should vaccinate our kids 5 to 11 is much, much higher. So Artagi last week in recommending boosters for the immune compromised touched very briefly on Pfizer for the 5 to 11 year group and said basically the same thing, that we're going to wait and see, but TGA, which is the Therapeutic Goods Administration, is probably going to have a slightly higher bar for whether or not they would even approve the use of the vaccines in kids ages 5 to 11 when the evidence is through.
Okay. So it's really just going to be a matter of time waiting to see what happens with that.
Yeah, but we'll probably know by December, to be honest.
Oh, cool. And if, that's great.
Yeah, and if all systems are good to go, we'll probably start vaccinating maybe in time for Christmas or certainly, hopefully, before the start of school next year.
Well, that's very exciting for the, you know, for everybody. I think that's
really
good for parents for peace of mind. I know that a lot of my friends sent their kids back to school very happily today.
Yeah.
Send them on the bus on their merry way.
Yeah.
I've learned so much from this chat. I can't believe how long we've been talking for already. But I do want to know, do you think we will ever get to have our old way of life back?
What do you mean by old way of life?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, when I said it, it's obviously the new normal now. And do you think we'll ever be a time where we don't have to wear masks anymore?
Well, if you listen to the premiere, it's from today, isn't it? Inside some businesses and the rest of it. So
how are we feeling about that?
I'm not happy about that.
Yeah.
I'm not happy about that. But, you know, I mean, a few weeks ago, Dr. Chant was saying she anticipated that we would be wearing masks for several years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, it's really normal.
And so, you know, but then again, we look at places like Europe where there's still mild restrictions. I mean, obviously there are some countries like Denmark which dropped all restrictions effective September 10th. I think from memory they still have masks on public transport and airports, but that's about it. They've dropped everything else. You know, we've got places like Norway that did that again recently. So we're sort of watching them and waiting to see what happens. The UK did that in July, but they're starting to get into some strife now where they have like over 1,000 people a week dying from COVID.
Gosh.
And so we certainly don't want to be there.
No.
Alberta's under strife because, again, they did the whole removal restrictions, were vaccinated enough, and their, you know, their health systems basically collapsed, while Toronto, which was a lot more cautious, is doing much, much better. So Ontario. Similarly, in the US, you know, Florida is really struggling and suffering at the moment. So is Texas, from what I hear. But San Francisco, which continued to have mask mandates even in schools, is doing quite well.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, wearing masks is not that big a deal. I know we see it as a huge deal.
No, not
but
at
if
all.
It means,
yeah, it's so normal, you know, now.
Yeah, and I think if we sort of think about it, at the moment, there's no sterilizing immunity. And if you know that you're going to let COVID enter your body through your nose, why wouldn't you just wear a mask if you're in a crowded place or around strangers or whatever it is? Even if it's just for the purposes of keeping yourself and your family safe, especially if you still have theoretically unvaccinated kids at home or people who are ineligible for whatever reason or who might be a little bit more immune compromised. In saying that, I think we are getting to a new normal, which may not be the same as the old normal, but I think a lot of people are looking forward to travel, and we see, you know, people in Europe where they're able to freely jet back and forth between the UK and Europe again. With the easing of travel restrictions internationally, we're going to have people flying overseas and coming back. And I know, and see, I had a friend say to me recently, and he said, you know, we forget in the midst of the pandemic that with the Spanish flu, it, you know, it lasted 4 years and it took the virus 2 years to reach peak infectivity, like worst case scenario. But, and this is what I said to him because he's not medical, but they didn't have vaccines back then.
No, very different situation.
And they didn't have the technology that we have.
We have the amazing technology and we have the most incredible frontline workers such as yourself. Thank you.
We do. They've been amazing. They really, really have. We all have.
So grateful to you.
But, you know, we couldn't have done it without all of you. I think you guys have just completely restored our faith in humanity. At the rate at which you've all come up. Because when all of this started and, you know, we were like, we'll be lucky if we get to 70 or 80%, but we've just kind of, you know, shot up and it's slowing down now. But I think with some 6% estimated to be an anti-vaccination population, we would quite easily get to maybe, you know, we've already gotten to 92%, but I think we'll get to around the high 90s. And that would be our best insurance against future lockdowns and you know, our best bet of getting back to a new normal.
Thank you so much for educating me today. I have learned so much. I hope that everyone listening has learned so much. I appreciate your time. I know you're literally talking to me from your office about to meet more patients. So thank you so much.
You are very welcome. Thank you so much for having me. You're welcome. I really appreciate it.
Okay, bye. Well, that was such a good chat. On next week's episode, I speak to former editor-in-chief of Vogue Australia and best-selling author Kirsty Clements. And if you like this chat, you can rate, follow and review and follow me on Instagram at AnitaAnnabelle_ and at The Good Chat Pod. See you next week.